Hello, and welcome to Travel Fun. My name is Mary Beth Clementi, and I'm the host of this talk show on travel. And this week, I have on the phone from Florida, Mark Spivak. And Mark is an author, blogger, former radio show host of the show Uncorked. He is a specialist in wine and spirits. And we are going to be talking about spirits. And Mark has a new book out called Iconic Spirits, An Intoxicating History. And that will be the main focus of today's interview. I'd like to welcome Mark Spivak to Travel Fun. Hi, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure, and it is the holiday season now, and it's a time when people tend to imbibe a little bit more, and I thought it would be very apropos to have you on the program so that people know what they are drinking. And, you know, I love knowing about products and the stories behind products and the history and tradition. And your new book, Iconic Spirits, An Intoxicating History, is filled with wonderful stories. So bravo. I really like what you did with it.
Well, thank you.
And also, I think it's very timely, as you say in the book, with the current cocktail culture and the interest that people have in specialty drinks. And people have become connoisseurs of spirits, so it's nice to know what they're talking about. Why don't you, in just so many words, talk about your new book, Iconic Spirits?
Well, basically the idea occurred to me one day when I was sitting around thinking about Campari, because I had done a story on Campari about 6 months earlier, and I was really fascinated with the fact that Campari was extremely bitter. It was something that I had personally a lot of trouble drinking. And we have these bitterness receptors on our tongues that basically function as an early warning system that we might be about to consume something that is poisonous or toxic. So basically, your brain is telling you, don't drink this because it could kill you. And at the same time, Campari has been marketed as one of the sexiest beverages on earth. So this really intrigued me. I started looking into it, and I started talking to scientists who did research on the physiology of taste. And they each had a different theory on why this was the case, but nobody really knew for sure. And from there, I just kind of started stumbling onto different aspects of spirits and the stories behind the spirits. And what amazed me was that they were just totally unknown to the average person, or at least to me.
And in your new book, Iconic Spirits, An Intoxicating History, you actually tell the story behind 12 spirits, and each story I find fascinating. Since you mentioned Campari, why don't you go ahead and talk a little bit about the composition of Campari and how that came to be?
Well, Campari is a bitter spirit. It's what would be known in Italy as an Amaro. And it was formulated around 1860 by Giuseppe Campari. And it's one of those things that is very popular in Italy. They consume enormous amounts of bitter spirits in Italy. But it's something that is very localized. When you go around the world, you see that certain cultures drink it and certain cultures don't. And when I was doing the research on Campari, I ran across a really interesting statement on the part of the company saying that their corporate values were transgression, seduction, and sensuality, which is the strangest statement of corporate values I have ever run across.
It sounds very Italian.
Yeah, yeah.
And Campari is actually comprised of a whole panoply of herbs.
60 herbs and tree bark and various things that are compounded and combined with alcohol and distilled water. The formula is extremely secret. Only a few people in the company know it. They could tell you, but they would have to kill you.
You know, that reminds me of the story behind Chartreuse, which you might be familiar with, that is made by the Chartreux monks in the Chartreuse Mountains in France. And I visited their distillery when I was working on my book, The Riches of France. And there I that's why I'm so attracted to your book, because I love telling the history and tradition behind all these wonderful products. And apparently for Chartreuse, only a few monks know the secret that has of this recipe that's been done for several centuries, and they all have taken the vow of silence. That's my humor, but anyway, it's true. All of these recipes are very secretive, and I think it's fun that you've talked about them in your book. Another interesting story you reveal is the connection between moonshine and NASCAR.
Yes, that is absolutely fascinating. And a lot of people don't know about that, because NASCAR has been very conscientious about trying to separate themselves from that part of their history. The people at NASCAR are trying to promote the sport as good, clean family entertainment along the lines of baseball. So, you know, they're trying to conceal the fact that most of the early drivers were all bootleggers. You know, they were guys that ran moonshine out of the hills, and they constantly worked on their cars to try to outrun the revenue agents, and at a certain point they started racing informally among themselves. And then in 1947 they got together and founded NASCAR. So what I did was I went to North Carolina and I interviewed a gentleman by the name of Junior Johnson, who was in the NASCAR Hall of Fame, and he was a legendary bootlegger. He was the one guy that the law could never catch. And he told me some amazing stories. It was a very powerful connection to a period of American history that has almost vanished.
Tell us about some of those stories.
Well, he developed all sorts of techniques on the road that are now very famous. When he was running moonshine out of the hills, he developed a technique called the bootlegger's turn, which you probably have seen on TV, where you downshift the car and you turn the wheel 180 degrees and you absolutely shift the car around. You turn it around in maybe 3 or 4 seconds, and then you floor it and you go the other direction, totally outrunning the revenue agents that are trying to pursue you. And if a government employee tried to do this on the road, they would wreck their car immediately. There's no way they could absolutely keep up with something like that. There was another case where Junior he went up to Charlotte and he bought a police radio. So the entire time that the revenue agents were trying to track him, he was monitoring their movements on the shortways. And one night they thought they had him cornered. They had him basically isolated on a bridge in the middle of nowhere with no way out. And they're sitting there waiting for him. And while they're waiting for him, all of a sudden they see these red flashing lights and they hear this siren. So they take down the roadblocks to allow their fellow agent to pass. And all of a sudden, who speeds by them at 100 miles an hour is Junior Johnson. So he had not only bought a police radio, but he had bought a siren and then the whole nine yards. So he did absolutely everything he could to outrun these people. And anything you could do on the road in those days to gain an advantage was enormously important.
And, of course, the memories of the Prohibition era were fairly fresh in their minds.
Yes, absolutely. What made this really interesting was that he has come full circle. He has put his name on a line of legal moonshine called Junior Johnson's Midnight Moon, which is being sold. It's being sold here in Florida. I'm not sure if it's available in Colorado or not. So he has really come back to a place where all of a sudden his entire history has been validated.
And hence the connection with NASCAR.
Right.
I am visiting with Mark Spivak. Mark is the author of Iconic Spirits and Intoxicating History. Wonderful book, and I really like the pictures in the book and all of the stories. It's a nice gift idea. I'd like to talk a little bit more about this, Mark, and then maybe focus, shift on your blog, and talk about some recent stories you did on Colorado distilleries.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get to that shortly. I like the names of your chapters. They're fun, and they make you wonder what's this all about. How about the chapter, Capturing Flowers in a Bottle?
That is a really interesting story. A gentleman by the name of Rob Cooper worked for actually the family business, which was Chambord. He worked for his father in a company that marketed Chambord, and he was in charge of marketing Chambord in Europe. And one day in London, he goes into a bar at the end of the day, and he sits down, and the bartender serves him an extract of elderflowers. And it was the first time that he had ever encountered elderflowers in an actual syrup, in something that could be mixed into a cocktail. And he was absolutely intrigued with this. So he came back to the U.S. and decided that this was going to be his mission, that he was going to try to produce a liqueur made from elderflowers. Got no support from anybody, got absolutely no support from his father, thought it was a crazy idea. And it took him 3 or 4 years and a number of false starts before he finally succeeded in doing this. But the result was Saint Germain, which is now one of the hottest spirits on the market.
Oh, and I thought that was raspberry.
No, actually, Chambord is raspberry.
Chambord is raspberry.
Yes,
and
right.
Saint Germain is the elderflower.
Mm-hmm.
And that is certainly a spirit that ladies love to sip?
Well, actually, ladies love it, but really it cuts across a lot of sort of generational lines and cultural lines. It's something that appeals to everybody. It's really almost irresistible when you encounter it.
And some of those, just like Chambord or Saint-Germain, it really does taste like flowers in a bottle. It's so
mm-hmm. right.
redolent.
Right.
That's a good chapter. How about the chapter, How the World Learned to Love Partially Decayed Vegetable Matter?
Well, you know, basically these 12 spirits were the ones that changed the world and created the cocktail culture. And a lot of them had stories that were just very compelling, totally unknown to the average person, and totally improbable. And in the case of scotch, and particularly single malt scotch, here you have something that smells and tastes absolutely disgusting, that the average person, the first time they smell it or taste it, is completely revolted. And basically, it's marketed as an acquired taste. It's marketed as something that people with extraordinary taste and distinction drink. And therefore, it's sort of a learned reaction. You learn how to drink this stuff, and you pretend over time that you appreciate it because it gives you a certain amount of social cachet.
Yes, it does, and I would agree it is an acquired taste. Let's go back to France, and me being the Francophile that I am, I certainly enjoyed reading about your history of cognac. And in fact, I learned about that and wrote about only a small part of it when I was in Cognac, which a lot of people don't realize is the name of a city in France, actually a region in France, and learned about cognac. Why don't you tell the story how cognac came to be?
Well, basically, in the Cognac region, which is just located just above Bordeaux, they were producing white wine from the native grape varieties, which were Uni Blanc, Colombard, and Full Blanche. And they were making a very, very thin sort of low-alcohol dilute style of white wine, which as time went on and the red wines of Bordeaux became more and more popular in the export market, nobody wanted this stuff. So they were basically faced with a dilemma, which was, how do we go forward and guard ourselves from going broke. And the solution they came up with was to distill this wine into a spirit and to barrel age it. And it was an incredible success. It caught on all over the world. And cognac is a great example of image marketing. There are a number of examples in this in the book of taking something that may or may not have intrinsic value, but convincing other people that it is just the coolest thing on earth. That if you drink this, you will have enormous social importance. You will be recognized as being a connoisseur. You'll be recognized as being a person of discernment, so on and so forth.
I'm not sure whether you bring this out in that chapter. I sort of did an overview of it, but I'm sure you know that so many of the cognac houses are tied into the champagne houses. And so hence that emphasis on luxury living.
Well, the stories are very similar because in Champagne you had a similar dilemma, which was that you had grapes that wouldn't ripen because the climate was very cold and it was very far north. So the dilemma was, what do you do with these grapes that you can't ripen and make wine out of? And the solution was to ferment them twice and make champagne out of them. So it's a very similar story to what you had in cognac, where they had lemons and they made lemonade. They had wine that nobody wanted, and they distilled it and put it in barrels and turned it into a spirit that was just the envy of every civilized person on earth.
Right. And when you look at a house such as Moët Hennessy, mm-hmm. and that's sort of the blending of the Moët et Chandon, the French, and the Hennessy, which, of course, so many of the people from the north were directly involved with the cognac in France because it was being shipped off to them originally.
Right, right.
What is your favorite story in the book?
Well, probably the one that you asked about in terms of NASCAR and moonshine, because interviewing Junior Johnson was a very powerful experience. It really was a link to a period of American history that has almost vanished.
And thank goodness we have writers such as yourself to keep that alive, those stories alive. Let's talk about, you have a blog, Mark, and that's iconicspirits.net.
Mm-hmm.
And there you have all kinds of stories, and you posted a couple of stories recently on the Colorado distilleries following a trip here.
Right. I was out there for about a week in October. And it was really a fascinating experience. I mean, it was just really remarkable. I visited a lot of people that were doing things that you couldn't even envision before you went out there. You know, obviously probably the most interesting place was Leopold Brothers. You know, they are just doing some amazing work.
And where's that located?
That is just outside of Denver.
And what kind of spirits are they making?
They do whiskey, they do gin, vodka, absinthe. They do an entire line. They do about 12 or 14 different spirits. But, you know, there were just some amazing small craft distillers, you know, with incredible stories. I visited a guy in Boulder by the name of 303 Vodka. And this guy, his grandfather came over to the U.S. around the turn of the century, around 1900, with all of his possessions in a steamer trunk from Poland. So maybe 80, 90 years later, this gentleman inherits the steamer trunk and doesn't know what to do with it and is looking through it one day and finds some paper in a lining of the trunk. And it's written in Polish. He doesn't know what it is, so he goes on Google. He starts to translate it, and he realizes it's a recipe. And then as he goes further, he realizes it's a recipe for potato vodka. So he did an experimental batch of his grandfather's potato vodka, and it turned out pretty well. And one thing led to another, and now this is what he does. And the stuff was really, really excellent.
And in most instances, are these distilleries working with pure Rocky Mountain water?
In a lot of cases. In some cases, they actually distill the base spirits themselves. In other cases, they purchase it. As you know, living out there, there's a very strong organic and sort of farm-to-bottle movement, both in wine and in spirits. And a good example of that would be Cap Rock and Peak Spirits, which are over in the western part of the state. You know, they're both using pure spring water and using basically locally sourced ingredients, either that they grow themselves or they know the farmers who are growing the grains for it.
Would you say that Colorado distinguishes itself as the front runner in the artisanal distillery business in the U.S.?
I think the pattern there is very similar to a lot of other states and to the pattern nationally, because 5 years ago they had maybe 3 or 4 craft distillers in Colorado, and today they have 40. So that gives you an idea of the explosion of this nationally. And it's similar in other states, but I think Colorado, for various reasons, is probably an extreme case.
And why do you think there is this interest in craft distilleries? Well, of course, it comes on the heels of how many 2 decades of the craft breweries gaining importance.
Well, from what I gather, I think there is a tremendous appreciation of artisan products of all sorts out there. Whether they're agricultural products or beers or wines or spirits or handicrafts, I think that your state places a real premium on that you don't find elsewhere. You certainly don't find it in Florida.
It's interesting to have your perspective, because you certainly are well-informed, and maybe people will keep this in mind when they're doing holiday shopping, and whether they're buying a big name, what's the story behind the big name, or maybe something from a craft distillery, they'll know what they're dealing with. That's kind of fun.
Yeah, I think what people have to remember is that in a lot of cases, the reputations of these famous brands have been created by multinational beverage conglomerates. You know, spirits marketing is very different from wine marketing. Wine marketing tends to be consumer-led. Consumers tend to decide independently what it is they want, and they go after it, and that's what creates the trends. But spirits marketing is basically top-down. A handful of people at the top of the pyramid decide what the trend is going to be, and then they put enough money into it to create it, to make it happen.
Do you see much of a difference in the price point between big-name spirits and craft distillery spirits?
Not really. When it comes to vodka, there's not a lot of reason why vodka should cost $30 or $35 or $40, because it's a manufactured product that does not need to be aged. Basically, as Sidney Frank said, you make it today, you sell it tomorrow. So there's absolutely no reason why anyone should pay $35 or $40 for a bottle of vodka, other than the fact that they're buying a certain image. Whether it's the image of Grey Goose or whether it's the image of a small artisan distillery, it's a created image. It's not based on the value of the product. It's perceived value, basically.
Do you have any tips, Mark, for holiday shoppers? This is definitely a time when people, even people that typically don't drink spirits, will pick up a bottle of something special to either sit by the fire or just spike their eggnog with. Do you have any tips?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously the trickiest thing is knowing the person you're buying for. And if you even have a passing acquaintance with the person and you have an idea of what they like, it becomes a whole lot easier. because you can zero it down to certain categories. And you know if the person really is a label buyer or if they appreciate the intrinsic quality of something. But I think the problem we all run into is what do you do when you're buying gifts for somebody that you sort of know but you don't really know? You know, that's the trick.
Well, maybe a copy of your book, Iconic Spirits, with a good bottle, and that would make somebody happy, I'm sure. Mark, we have just a few minutes left. I would like you to touch on briefly your thoughts on the cocktail culture.
Well, there have been three or four major boom periods in the cocktail culture in America. Obviously, the turn of the 20th century was one of them, you know, the period right before World War I. The period right after World War II, what we now refer to as the, you know, the era of the Mad Men, the 1950s and 60s. And certainly the current period that started more or less in the mid to late 90s, where there has just been an unprecedented boom in cocktails and artisan spirits. And it all really started with Sidney Frank and Grey Goose. That was the first super premium spirit. And that was the first spirit that sort of lent an aura of connoisseurship to spirits, which is something that previously had been reserved for wine drinkers.
So what's your recommendation for when you go out and want to order a cocktail?
Well, I'm a whiskey drinker, so I will tend to order a Manhattan, but the problem is that it's very difficult to get a good Manhattan in a bar, because to my way of thinking, a good Manhattan is four parts whiskey to one part vermouth, and you're not going to get that in a bar because whiskey is more expensive than vermouth, and most bars are trying to retail cocktails for $12 and still make money. So it's pretty tough in that scenario to get a good cocktail.
So are you saying that you should call out what kind of whiskey you want used for your Manhattan?
Well, I think you should, you know, sit at the bar, and if the bar is busy, that's perfect because it gives you a couple of minutes to observe the bartender, to observe how conscientious and detail-oriented the bartender is, whether they're measuring things, whether they're being sloppy, to what extent they're listening to people. I had a really interesting experience last year. I was out in Wisconsin, in Lake Geneva, and I was in a place called the Baker House, which had just an amazing bar. And what made it amazing was that they had two or three bartenders who were incredibly intuitive. You walked in there, and if you were undecided, if you didn't know what you wanted, they would just strike up a conversation with you. For a couple of minutes, they would talk to you about, you know, what you like and what you drink at home and blah, blah, blah. And after a couple of minutes of this, they would start to make you a cocktail based on what you had said. And most of the time, they were absolutely on target.
Wow, those are real pros. That's a good note to end on. I have been visiting with Mark Spivak, author of Iconic Spirits, and Mark is also a blogger, writer. His website is iconicspirits.net. Mark, thank you so much for being a guest on Travel Fun. I am going to be posting this on my blog, bonjourcolorado.com, and thank you for all your storytelling.
Well, thanks for having me. It was fun.
And happy holidays.
Same to you. Thanks very much.
Take care. Cheers,
bye-bye.
I should say.
Cheers, yeah.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay.
Come on, fly with me, we'll float down in the blue.
Fly with me, float down to Peru.